Okay, I'm going to talk about some work that I've been involved with, but not exclusively. I'm going to talk about work that I also haven't been directly involved with, summarizing what's been, I think, a new phase of phenomenological exploration of work compactifications. Of course, in light of the ADS-CFT correspondence, there are always two views of almost anything you can say. And in fact, I want to start on the side of, you know, no extra dimensions, just strong interactions, and talk about the problems of going beyond the standard model, in particular solving the hierarchy problem. And so I want to just recap some history here, okay? So let's start at this end, the unpopular end, okay? So we know, of course, that one way of attacking the problem of the hierarchy problem, the why the weak scale is smaller than much higher scales we can imagine, like the Planck scale, one approach to it was Technicolor, which basically tried to replay electroweak symmetry breaking in the image of chiral symmetry breaking in the strong interactions, and of course ran into problems of some rather crucial, even qualitative details. But that's certainly the image that most of us people who work in strong dynamics at the weak scale have in mind. There were refinements of this kind of idea, the idea that the strongly interacting theory at the weak scale, which is somehow what we're looking for, solving the hierarchy problem, actually produces, doesn't directly break chiral symmetries, it actually produces a composite Higgs, which is something like a pion, which then develops a potential and breaks some further symmetries. There were also in the 80s the idea of walking Technicolor, that before the strong theory does its thing, produces a mass gap and so on, breaks some symmetries, it enjoys a large conformal regime, approximately conformal regime. A much lesser known idea was introduced in the early 90s by David Kaplan, B. Kaplan, which I will call partial compositeness, okay? Almost totally ignored, the idea of partial compositeness is that in some sense the couplings of the ordinary fermions and the ordinary particles of the standard model to the Higgs sector, this enlarged, strongly interacting Higgs sector, came by mixing, say, the electron with, say, technibaryons, okay? So there was sort of mixing between composite states and fundamental particles, so that any particular particle an experimentalist picks up is in fact a little bit of a mix of a composite and a fundamental field. For example, that sort of the well-known example in the real world is what's called photon row mixing, but this was enhanced to all the other particles. So in fact, the idea that we're going to pursue here is maybe has the ugly name. This is the theme on the dual side of what's going to be pursued here, partial walking compositeness. This really never took off because it wasn't a very rich structure for generating flavor structure in the standard model, this idea of mixing fundamental and composite states. But when you add it to sort of conformal field theory and the rich spectrum of possible anomalous dimensions, putting these two ideas together is really a very rich, explosive, and promising mix. And that's the topic that I'm actually pursuing here. It is mostly being pursued. It could have been imagined before anything was done in ADS, okay? But in fact, the main ideas could have been set forth, but it really emerged from people playing with putting standard model fields in the bulk of an RS1 space-time, okay? So that's the idea that we're going to be pursuing, although Matt Strassler, for example, would find many of the ideas here very similar in spirit, but with some crucial differences in his work with Ann Nelson on conformal field theories and supersymmetry and supersymmetry breaking. Okay, and some of the ideas really go back to there. Okie doke. So what were the tools of the trade back then for studying all of these ideas? These are strongly interacting theories, non-perturbative. Well, one was experiments. And of course, the instant you then decided to go beyond something that was a literal copy of QCD, experiments became useless. There was the large N color expansion, of course. That's a very powerful tool, but certainly doesn't give you everything. when you have a regime of scale invariance, then you have that, at least that symmetry, modulated by thinking about deformations and the anomalous dimensions of the operators that you're deforming your CFT by. Wonderful old tools are flavor symmetry and unitarity, and in particular, combined with large N, these are really very powerful constraints on any sort of strong interaction dynamics. Another is sort of common sense or dimensional analysis, where you pull out all the large and small factors, including powers of 4 pi, and whatever's left has got to be order 1. And when all this failed in the old days, you would toss in dynamical assumptions. Okay, you'd say, here, let me throw out 3 or 4 dynamical assumptions about my favorite construction for a strongly interacting theory, and hope that they are consistent. In fact, there wasn't really a way, in some sense, of checking the consistency of your dynamical assumptions, but that was the best that could be done. Well, post ADS CFT, a couple of things have changed, and that's what I want to talk about. So one is, yeah, we do have to sort of put experiments aside. Just doesn't look like what's happening at the weak scale is a replay of QCD in detail. The 1 over n expansion is wonderful, we'll keep it. Scale invariance, of course, is understood to imply conformal invariance, and in fact, one wants to make heavy use of the full symmetry. There's a new small parameter that we gain post-ADS-CFT in a way, and that is when you have a gap in the spectrum of anomalous dimensions between some finite number that are either relevant or marginal operators, and then there's a large gap, that's what I mean by delta gamma, there's a large gap, and then you get sort of the cruddy irrelevant operators, which are very irrelevant. If there is such a gap, you can actually do a systematic expansion, and in some sense, this is what in large N Suzy Yang-Mill circles one thinks of as the TUF coupling. Okay, but in general, this is what you're using to try and get the sort of what's called the supergravity approximation or the gravity approximation from a string theory approximation. Well, if you combine all of these, the things that we're ticking and the modifications or the enlargements of these older ideas, then in fact you are led to play with five-dimensional warped effective field theory as the dual of these strongly interacting theories with these kinds of features. Okay, it's this that RS effective field theories or warped effective field theories are pursuing. In disguise, they are using all of these small and large parameters that are shown here. Okay, as well as all the symmetries. And warp effective field theory has a self-consistency. There's a set of rules when you're using a warped effective field theory, like any other effective field theory. And of course, there's a lot of one's understanding of how you go between these two pictures comes from ADS-CFT. I should just say, it is a non-renormalizable effective field theory one is talking about. Some people think that non-renormalizable means just dead. Of course, that's not true. Some will grant that Einstein did the right thing by writing down general relativity before he invented string theory, but surely that's only true at tree level. Even that's not true. People like John Donahue know that they can actually and have calculated the leading quantum corrections to Newton's law, which are finite, UV finite, and therefore rather robust against whatever string theory corrections there may be. But there's one extra trick that warped effective field theories have up their sleeve, that the normal non-renormalizable effective field theory gets its biggest applications in the far infrared. Because of the weird way the warping changes the scales as you pass around the extra dimension, there's a sort of a nuanced effective field theory that you have to relearn the rules of to say what is systematic, what is not. And so many quantities in these effective field theories are UV sensitive and you can't calculate, you can estimate them, but you can't calculate them. And many quantities are calculable in even at loop level and are important in warped effective field theory. Okay. So we're going to switch and talk about what progress has been made in warped effective field theory. In fact, many of the questions in the old RS1 way of doing particle physics, which was to put all the standard model on one of the brains, it turned out that many of the exciting questions of experiments, other than just the weak Planck hierarchy, were all UV dominated. You couldn't robustly say anything about them in effective field theory. The nice thing is that, in fact, when you put the standard model in the bulk, all of a sudden, lots and lots of experimentally relevant quantities become IR-dominated, and you can sort of calculate them, see how they go. And this was done in a large number of insightful papers. But in fact, they were so predictive that they all gave massive conflicts with data, compositeness, electroweak precision tests, you name it. It was a just total disaster, it would appear. Although there were the ways of computing were actually very nice, okay, things that a person familiar with ADS-CFT, I don't say that viciously, I really mean it, that in fact, for us, our Hopkins group was very excited that there were things that were relevant to experimentalists that you could actually calculate in this framework and were IR dominated. It means this is the first step in, if you want to change the rules and then have some viable dynamics, it might come, you know, from the fires, from the ashes of this sort of setup. In fact, some work is being done now by people at Hopkins, but also various other places. And in fact, I think there's sort of a global picture that we are starting to see. And I think it's a very exciting picture. And I can say it in kind of one slogan and then try and back it up through the rest of the talk. And that slogan is that once you start considering a warp compactification with fields in the bulk, gauge theory, fermions, gravity in the bulk, and it's all non-supersymmetric, if you just do the most natural thing and you kind of pretty much do anything anarchically, here's the slogan, okay, that we're finding. That five-dimensional chaos, by which I mean you just write down things without any particular couplings, all couplings are order one in terms of some fundamental scale, that out of this, with very mild hierarchies in the 5D theory, get blown up into large hierarchies and protective mechanisms, not just hierarchies, but protective mechanisms in the four-dimensional theory, very, very, very reminiscent of the way the world looks. If you just take a random gauge theory up here, it'll look like some sort of caricature of the real world. It won't have 3, 2, 1 as the gauge groups, but it'll have something which is in the same class. It'll have things like CKM angles. It'll protect itself from flavor-changing neutral currents. All of these things will happen. That's the miracle. That's why I think it's worth studying. Okay. So what is all this structure that I'm talking about? When I say safety and structure, what am I actually talking about? So let me take a quick tour through the particle data book here. Okay. So let's just get our arms right around it and say once and for all, what are all the things that we think are important, worth considering? Protons are stable. There's a big Planck-weak hierarchy. Gauge couplings are all order one, okay, roughly speaking. Yukawa couplings have huge hierarchies. Their Ws can decay into particles which come from different families, and these mixing angles are larger the more closely related in mass the decay products are in mass. All the discrete space-time symmetries are broken. Neutrinos have tiny masses and oscillate. Dark matter is well fit by weakly interacting particles at the weak scale. Dark energy is really tiny. And I'll have very little to say about it, except to say that anything I say is at least consistent with, you know, an anthropic view of dark energy. I'm not changing that aspect of things from what's popular today. And of course, all of this is kind of, yes, this is the structure you're positing, but there's also the stuff that you don't see. And it's not obvious why you don't see it until you take a course in the standard model. So, of course, you look directly in experiments and you try to see physics beyond the standard model, and your reach is the energy at which you run your collider around a TEV. But you also do sort of virtual searches by doing precision tests. So one is, of course, electroweak precision tests, which roughly speaking get you up to around 10 TEV or so. And of course, we haven't seen something beyond the standard model. Then you do, with adding more and more theoretical sort of viewpoints, you can probe further. For example, you can look and say, you know, it's remarkable, these Ws can change flavors, they can change families in their decays. This U and the D can come from different families, but this is the dominant way in the standard model and in experiments by which flavor changing is accomplished, Are there any other ways that we can see experimentally? And by seeing nothing, you are starting to probe energies up to 1,000 TeV, okay? And then you can say, you know, gauge coupling unification in this supersymmetric standard model is nearly bang on perfect. That's amazing. And so in that sense, that's a way of summarizing the data. You could say, oh, I'm probing by looking at gauge couplings and running them up to looking at really high energies. Okay, so all of this is going on, and this is what I think is worth thinking about. So what's the trick up the sleeve of these warp compactifications that allows them to address all of these kinds of issues? And it's a very simple trick to draw a picture of, if I can find one transparency here. So here it is. Where does all this structure and safety come from? It's all wave function overlaps, okay? So once you put all these fields in the bulk, you find that the light fields that we actually see experimentally today have various profiles in the bulk. And in order to couple to each other, of course, by locality, it's only the overlap of their wave functions. Any coupling has to be proportional to the overlap of their wave functions. And these overlaps give all the small and large parameters that sort of are going in the direction of giving a caricature of that particle data book. Okay. So this idea of wave function overlaps originated in flat space, but really works sort of, in my sense, I would say, very well, better in warp space times. Okay, so that's the theme. In fact, even the sort of RS mechanism for sort of warped hierarchies can be phrased in this way. I know most people are familiar with all of this, so I'll just say it very quickly and then show a picture. So, of course, the idea in a warp compactification is, one, you have one Planck brain, one IR brain. These may have more structure than I'm indicating here, but these are the bare moving parts. And in the bulk, generically, there's a cosmological constant. It could be negative, in which case one has sort of a slice of anti-de Sitter space here. The ADS radius of curvature is shown here, and one is considering a compactification which is somewhat larger, again, no very large or small hierarchies, but somewhat larger than order 10 larger than the ADS radius. And stabilized by some number of scalar fields or other fields, actually. It doesn't have to be scalar fields, can stabilize this kind of setup, this compactification. There's some warp metric. The main thing is, here's the non-trivial thing, that four-dimensional mass scales that you get after compactification are related to the five-dimensional mass parameters you put in, multiplied by the warp factor at the scale, at the position, this is the extra dimensional coordinate y, at the position where whatever physics you're talking about lives. Okay, if it is dominantly got a wave function that looks like this, then this y is what you stick in here. And so this formula is the magic formula that tells you how, without having very large hierarchies in the extra dimensions, but spreading things out in different ways, you can get a large hierarchy of four-dimensional scales. Okay. This applies equally well to the ultraviolet cutoff of this effective field theory, presumably string theory, okay? That the five-dimensional cutoff is actually maybe some constant big value, but the four-dimensional cutoff, effectively, on effective field theory calculations, is greatly varying across here. So you find that there are many quantities which are at low energies calculable, but you also find that there are some particular types of quantities, mostly what you would call inclusive processes, that you can actually say something about at energies far above the warped down IR scale. Okay. Now, I don't want to keep going for lack of time in that formal way. I just want to say that even this can be said in a wave function overlap language. One can just say that the RS observation is the fact that you can have the four-dimensional graviton has this kind of profile, highly dominated over on the Planck brain. that if you imagine the Higgs, and we'll come back to explore this in a little more detail, if you imagine the Higgs by hand living at the IR brain in this effective field theory, that there is a very small overlap between the graviton and the Higgs. By the equivalence principle, that means that the Higgs mass is small, and that's, of course, at the core of the hierarchy problem. Why is the Higgs mass small? And so I'm saying it here in terms of wave function overlaps. One other thing to keep in mind throughout the rest of the talk is, whatever bulk fields you consider, without regard to what the field is, all of their KK modes end up having wave functions dominated towards the IR. And so their masses are also small, by the same argument, their masses are also small. Small here always means of order the weak scale, okay? We'll come to more precise numbers later. Okay, so that's just a rehash of the old RS mechanism. What about all the other fields that I might consider in the bulk, okay? And so one wants to go through all of these. And of course, you're considering every possible thing that can happen. In particular, since you have an extra dimension, which is an interval, you can have Dirichlet or Neumann boundary conditions here. I'm a little bit oversimplifying, but for this talk, that's fine. There's Dirichlet or Neumann boundary conditions, and you can rewrite this all in terms of orbifold boundary conditions. I won't. But you get a number of interesting possibilities as you just go through every combination you can think of that makes sense, okay, in five-dimensional effective field theory. Let's do gauge fields, okay? So you can take the four-dimensional components of a gauge field to be Neumann. Of course, it's the Neumann-Neumann boundary conditions which generically give you something that survives well below the compactification scale. So I'm writing down in this column who survives well below the compactification scale or the Kaluza-Klein scale. If it's a mu that's got Neumann-Neumann, you get four-dimensional gauge fields. You can also have Neumann-Neumann boundary conditions for the fifth component of the gauge field, and that turns out to behave, walk and talk, and is dual to a Goldstone boson, okay? Which is a source of light scalars, okay? There's this sort of mixed boundary condition case, Neumann-Dirichlet, which is in fact in the news because it relates to sort of these Higgsless models, which are dual to a form of walking technicolor. I will not talk about this any further just because I think in detail, not in caricature form, but in detail, I think they have trouble with the data, with electroweak precision data. But this other mixed guy is actually one of the heroes of my story, which is Dirichlet-Neumann, which turns out to give rise to what I'll call custodial global symmetries, and I'll talk about those in a little bit more detail. It does not give rise to any light particle. It gives rise to something more abstract, which we'll talk about later. 5D fermions, of course, decompose in 4D as left and right. They're Dirac fermions. But boundary conditions can sort of give chirality. If it's Neumann-Neumann for left-handed fermions, then you get a four-dimensional left-handed guy in the infrared, mixed boundary conditions, and you don't get any chirality or anybody surviving. Scalars are naturally heavy, right, because there's no supersymmetry, so I won't write anything there. Gravity, if I take the four-dimensional components to be Neumann-Neumann and even G55, I get the 4D graviton and the radion. Higher spins, and nothing can survive far below MKK. The only purpose of this column is to say that in the presence of five-dimensional mass terms, then typically nothing survives in the infrared, except for these fermions, where you can actually put a certain form of mass term in where it changes the profile of the chiral zero modes, but the chiral zero modes survive despite having a five-dimensional mass. That is, the four-dimensional mass is zero, even though a five-dimensional mass is non-zero. Other than that, it's more or less intuitive. So we're just going to go through and see what physics comes out of each of these kinds of chaotic choices. I, of course, want all of these to be happening. Okay, so gauge fields. What you find is that the zero mode for the gauge fields where a mu is Neumann-Neumann are flat, and the profile for the wave function of the A5 for Neumann-Neumann are strongly peaked in the IR. Okay, so because they're flat, these gauge fields, a mu, 4D gauge fields, it's as if they don't see the warping at all. So the matching of four-dimensional gauge couplings to five-dimensional gauge couplings is just multiplication by the volume of the extra dimension. But since this volume is what is solving the hierarchy problem in RS language, you can write that as sort of the log of the hierarchy. And so that's one place where you sort of get gauge couplings looking like logs. But remarkably, you can study various aspects of the running of these gauge couplings even at higher energies at loop level. And a number of us studied it in great detail. And remarkably, for people who are used to higher dimensional gauge theories, there is a remnant of logarithmic running of gauge couplings above the IR scale, not surprising in light of ADS-CFT, but you can study it here, making use of the large TUF coupling to work on the gravity side. Okay, and it was taken very seriously because it was at least the first step towards getting logarithmic coupling constant unification in a grand unified setup, which I'll talk about a little later. We all had a crack at grand unification back in these days, but I think there's something very exciting that's emerged more recently, so I'll come back to that. These A5s that are over here at the IR brain walk and talk like Goldstone bosons, okay? Where the spontaneous symmetry breaking, or the decay constant of the Goldstone bosons, is this IR scale, okay? These 4D custodial global symmetries that I talked about before are essentially symmetries that are respected by the Kaluza-Klein excitations. They may or may not be respected by the very low energy four-dimensional effective theory. Okay, so this we'll see an instance of each of these cases later, and as I said, they will play an important role. The main thing you need to keep in mind is that that KK excitations come in complete multiplets of these global symmetries, these custodial symmetries. Okay, so fermions are also quite interesting. Again, let's just take some left-handed modes that are being given Neumann-Neumann boundary conditions, and they survive in the infrared as chiral fermions. It's important to think about their mass parameter in 5D, usually written in multiples of 1 over the ADS radius, the multiple just being a dimensionless number C. The reason this is so important is that the zero modes are their profiles are very sensitive to the C, some order one number C. Here's what they look like. C equals a half, and these things look pretty flat. C bigger than a half, you're dominated, the wave function lives at near the Planck scale, or the Planck brain, okay? C less than a half, and it lives further near the IR, and everything in between that you can imagine, okay? The reason this is interesting is because it's a very simple source for Yukawa hierarchies. Of course, to couple to the Higgs, which at the moment I'm keeping right here on the IR brain, comes from wave function overlaps. So these C bigger than half guys have very small Yukawa couplings, C less than a half, and you have order one Yukawa couplings. And I show you here what these wave functions evaluated at the Higgs look like as a function of C. Here's C bigger than a half, you get exponential sensitivity. C less than a half, things are order one, just what the picture would suggest. And if you take this kind of picture and you say, well, of course, there are no very large hierarchies, but there can be order one hierarchies, left, right, and center, you find that you can derive very simple relations for CKM mixing angles, which actually experimentally seem to work reasonably well, okay? There's some sort of a pattern that all of us can see in the CKM angles and quark masses of nature. No very precise Balmer series-like precision, but there's something going on, and this is certainly consistent with that and mildly explanatory of it, okay? Okay, so that's the sort of the structure part, but really it's the safety part that's also very important in this story. Safety here doesn't mean safety for you to live. It means just safety from all of these experimental constraints, I should say. Things like flavor changing neutral currents, compositeness effects, excessive electric dipole moments, the S parameter of electroweak precision tests, all of these things, what saves you from having sort of massive contributions from KK physics to all of this stuff is easy to understand. Once you see that light fermions are the ones whose wave functions are away from the Higgs, whereas all of the KK modes I told you have wave functions dominated by the IR. And so, for example, if there's some dangerous effect involving light fermions mediated by KK modes, which is the new physics just above the weak scale, then it's going to be suppressed by wave function overlaps. Okay, that's the key to this whole thing. You could also write higher dimension operators just involving the fermionic fields in higher dimensions, in five dimensions. But again, because they live over here, the four dimension, once you translate the suppression scale in four-dimensional language, it's going to be a scale somewhere around here, the warp-down scale around here, which is a much higher scale of suppression than the weak scale, which is the warp-down scale somewhere around here. Okay, so this kind of picture of wave function overlaps, again, very simply explains why these effects are small, and of course we've been studying this in quantitative detail. In fact, I now want to say, putting all of this together, if you just, again, try and write out what would a typical, however you want to define it, what would a typical warped compactification look like if it's a little bit larger, you know, it's a slightly large extra dimension, you would find that you were getting a lot of the structures and safety mechanisms that we actually see in experiment. But it was only quite last year that we sort of put things together to try and get things to work in sort of real-world data. And that's where these custodial symmetries turned out to play a sort of crucial role, okay? In particular, we tried to make sure we understood both flavor physics, how it was generated, which I tried to show you, as well as electroweak precision tests. And in particular, we were focusing on this aspect. Just to show you what the numbers ended up looking like, the first generation had C's roughly shown here, second generation C's roughly shown here. The top right, to fit the data, had to have a C, which is sort of corresponding to being plastered in the IR here. The top left, bottom left had to have something a little bit flatter. Why? Because we need the top to be heavy, so you want the top left to be a little bit dominated by the IR scale near the Higgs, but the bottom left, which we are testing in precision data, you don't want a lot of compositeness effects from KK exchange to infect the bottom left. So this was the fit that we got, and in order to avoid all experimental constraints, the figure of merit here was that the KK scale is bigger than 3 TeV. Okay, so that's sort of where we were at those days. I'll tell you the significance of this number. Who cares what it is, right? But I'll tell you the significance of that in a little bit. That's the new physics scale. The main thing we found was that, or the main thing that solved many of the problems that came up in the sort of early history of the subject were solved by not writing the standard model gauge group in the bulk, but by enhancing it with this SU2 right factor, okay? Something that is called custodial isospin, but normally in model building, custodial isospin is put in as a global symmetry. Not surprisingly, in light of ADS-CFT, here you have to put it in as a gauge symmetry, and it's exactly behaving like what I called a custodial symmetry before. It turns out to be a symmetry of KK excitations. This turned out to be important for what's called the T parameter of electroweak precision tests, where the Z can mix after electroweak symmetry breaking with the what would have been hypercharged KK excitations, sort of the T3 generator of SU2 right is roughly speaking hypercharge. But unless you actually enlarge the T3 generator to all of SU2 right, you wouldn't have these charged right-handed W's, and if you don't have this partner for this graph, that puts you in tremendous violation of T parameter constraints. That was what was holding up the subject. Once you see how to do this, then everything is hunky-dory. Another thing we identified was that there were finite loops involving the top quark and its KK excitations, which were very important in understanding the T parameter, but they were finite calculable things that we could do. Okay. The other case, so custodial isospin is something that in the standard model, you can identify custodial isospin as a symmetry of the Higgs sector. So it wasn't a great surprise that it should be there in the UV, and that's how it was realized. Another way custodial symmetries can be realized is they can be symmetries of the KK states, but which aren't apparent at all in the IR theory. Okay, you can't see them in the IR, except that they leave a fingerprint on some precision data, which, however, then mystifies you forevermore. You think, how in the world do I explain that? Okay, and in fact, unification of couplings is one example in this scenario of how that works. Okay, and quite remarkably, in the last couple of months or so, we found that the model that we optimized just for the electroweak precision data and flavor physics seems to automatically, not adding any more bells and whistles, seems to automatically give a unification qualitatively different, but at the level of precision of Susie Guts. Okay? And the checking part is that we're just trying to, so let me say this is preliminary, we're trying to make sure that we have our large and small parameters under complete control, but let me give you the idea because it's so simple. The idea is that you take the gauge group I gave you on the previous transparency and you just elevate it to some, you say that maybe it came out of a single simple group like SO10, okay? Which however has only Neumann boundary conditions on the Planck brain being the standard model, whereas Neumann boundary conditions for all the generators on the IR brain. Okay, then this thing, all the extra generators in SO10 not in the standard model, are all custodial symmetries of the KK modes. The reason that's important is that if you do differential running, 3-2-1 running up to very high scales, then to leading order in thinking about this, the KK modes don't contribute to the running, okay, to the differential running. It's just the zero modes that are contributing. This is a sort of first approximation. Namely, four-dimensional standard model gauge fields, which are not in complete multiplets of SO10. The first and second generations, which are in complete multiplets, so they're not a big part. The third generation, because it has this kind of wave functions dominated in the IR, which is the dual of being very partially composite, the third generation quarks only contribute partially to the running. It's as if you took the top quark away from the running, okay? Plus some other effects which one can actually calculate in ADS effective field theory. And the remarkable thing is that when you plot the sort of the differential running, that you get a rather precise unification at around 10 to the 15 GeV. All the group theory is a little bit different. You know, removing top quarks is not like adding Higgs zenos. It's not, but and the calculation is different, but rather remarkably, this model that was optimized for totally different effects automatically seems to have this kind of unification within it, and we're trying to study that very carefully to make sure that we're not selling you a pack of lies. So, okay. But this is the idea. Here, the custodial symmetry is one that you would not see in the far infrared, but it shows itself on certain precision data, in this case, the gauge couplings. Okay. In this story, I won't go into the mechanism for baryon number non-violation, for protecting baryon number, but that mechanism gives a gut partner of the top quark, which has right-handed neutrino quantum numbers and is a KK excitation. It makes it stable, and it acts as a rather serviceable dark matter candidate. Okay, so that model obviously deserves, I think, to be studied in experiments, and clearly some of the lighter physics can be seen by looking at the compositeness effects that are there. So, okay, the light fermions don't seem to have much compositeness; they don't mix very much with KK modes, but of course the top quark does. Okay, and it's not ruled out because we haven't studied the top quark in enormous detail. But when we can, okay, once we really have top factories like even the LHC or a linear collider, then one can try and study the sort of the structure of the top quark and see whether it's standard model-like or not. Before that, the next most composite particle is in fact the left-handed bottom quark, the partner of the top left, which inherits some sort of composite-y effects by coupling to the KK gluon, and also flavor-violating and even CP-violating effects generically show up here, which can be studied at a host of different processes at B factories. In fact, some constraints have already emerged from just the sort of recent data at B factories, like a couple of months ago or something. But this is a very interesting laboratory for looking for this kind. It may even precede LHC for seeing effects of this kind of compositeness that shows up due to these wave function overlaps and the fact that the bottom left has a sizable wave function overlap with KK modes. Okay, so that's something that's being studied. There's some new work that was done sort of after we did the electroweak precision test fit. There's one more beautiful thing that I have not been doing, but my postdocs have, so I have to tell you about it, which is really very nice, okay? It's the fact that up till now I've kind of said the Higgs lives on the IR brain, which was the storyline in the old RS stories. But actually, it turns out the fine-tuning associated with having a 3 TV KK threshold is substantial. And there's a very beautiful idea, which is the dual of composite Higgs, a la Kaplan-Georgi, which is to identify the Higgs scalar of the standard model with some of the A5 components of five-dimensional gauge fields. Okay, so those are the Goldstone bosons. Studied in a sort of simplified, not quite realistic setup here, but now, right now, I think they've done it, they're just writing it up, talking about it in sort of the full level of detail with all the precision test data and flavor physics and so on. And the simplest model of this type can be just visualized right here. Great. The idea is that SU2 left cross SU2 right, what I talked about before, electroweak cross custodial symmetry, is now, of course, that's isomorphic to SO4, but you enhance it to SO5. Okay, imagine that you started with this. And again, here, if you have boundary conditions which on the IR brain, which break SO5 to SO4, then one of the A5s, or rather four of the A5s, turn out to be a four of SO4 and have exactly Higgs quantum numbers, okay, under SU2 left cross SU2 right. And if somehow this thing, which at leading order is just a Goldstone boson, if somehow we give it a potential, it can actually, a wine bottle potential, it can further break SU2 left cross SU2 right down to the diagonal, and that's electroweak symmetry breaking once you toss in hypercharge. Okay, so that's the plan. What is it that is going to generate a potential for these Goldstone bosons? Well, if I take this Planck brain and throw it away, which many people in this conference would not, you know, would do, right? You wouldn't talk about that. Then, in fact, this would be an exact Goldstone boson. But at the Planck scale reside all the dirty, chaotic effects you can think of. And who's talking to the Planck brain? Well, many of the fermions and other fields in the bulk are talking, okay? So you can actually look at vacuum polarization. So here's A5, here's a loop of top quarks in the bulk, and here's A5 again. And you find that these things actually do generate a potential for the Higgs. And that in the natural range of parameters, you can find the choice of parameters such that, in fact, you get electroweak symmetry breaking, that the potential is actually sort of radiative symmetry breaking. Loops of the top quark, KK tower, including the top, generate a potential for the Higgs that drives it to break electroweak symmetry breaking. Okay, so it generates a BEV. Now, the nice thing about this, compared with saying the Higgs is just a particle that lives on the IR brain, it's a scalar, is that you greatly lower the fine-tuning, for reasons I could explain after the talk, you greatly reduce the fine-tuning of these models with 3 TeV. I won't. Okay, I'll finish. That the fine-tuning for 3 TeV KK modes is around 10% in order to get electroweak symmetry breaking. So that's the very nice thing that I think those models have. I'll stop by just telling you the sort of things that I think need to be done in the future. One is to think very hard about collider signals. Obviously, the big signal is these 3TeV KK modes, and anybody that thinks about the LHC a little bit knows that 3TeV is hard going. So you're trying to look for all sorts of indirect things, and there may be some clever tricks for directly seeing them. Of course, I talked about studying the top quark. We should think about how to incorporate neutrino masses. There's some thought. Cosmology poses some very easy things, some maybe quite easy, but we don't know yet, and some tough things like the electroweak phase transition. A lot of thought has already been gone into, I haven't talked about it, just into seeing how could you visualize this coming out of string theory. In particular, how could you get the large breaking of SUSY that you might need? Large breaking of SUSY is, of course, topical. The other thing is the robustness against, you know, there's kind of a divide in the audience, me and everybody else. I say, oh, it's all five-dimensional effective field theory, and everybody else says it's all 10-dimensional string theory. And the structures in 10 dimensions are so much richer than these very simplified pictures. Do they matter? And actually, they don't matter in terms of the grand scheme of things, but do they matter in some of the numbers? Maybe, and the robustness needs to be checked. Okay, so I'll stop there.
Okay. Questions?
This is probably just my ignorance, Raman. On the last slide, you showed the electroweak symmetry breaking potential generated by the top loop. Is there some interplay of signs here which makes it a stable symmetry breaking potential? Because top loops usually have a negative contribution.
Yeah, there are also quartic couplings. So I've only drawn sort of this vacuum polarization diagram. But there are also diagrams that look like this. So the quartic couplings are also there and can stabilize the that, right? Because you get negative mass squared here, but you also have...
When you sum those, you still get a negative contribution from the top loop usually.
To the quartic?
Yeah.
Not in this thing. In this
That's why I'm asking, because I'm probably missing what...
Right. No, here you actually get positive mass squared. So what you get are actually things that look like... So these A5s are essentially angular variables. So any potential of them cannot run away in any way. So there's no possibility of runaway. There's either they have zero angle as the VEV, or they have some finite angle as the VEV, which is hard to see in the way I've said it, but they are angular variables. In fact, they're Goldstones, so they live in some sort of coset space.
Other questions? I have a question. If there,
sure.
In the way you presented the talk, you didn't emphasize so much the CFT, or let's say just the field theory interpretation of some of these things.
Sure.
Can you say a little bit more about the interpretation of the unification?
Yes.
How does that emerge from the field theory?
Yeah. So in this version of unification, from the 4D point of view, the SO10 is not a symmetry, is not a gauge symmetry. It's actually a global symmetry of the Higgs sector. So the Higgs is coming out as a composite of some strongly interacting dynamics, and we're saying that that strong dynamics respects SO10 global symmetry, of which we are gauging 3-2-1. Okay, we're just gauging the standard model subgroup. However, the nice thing happens if in the dual of all these models, the UV cutoff is a place where all couplings, including gauge couplings, are near their Landau poles. Okay, they're roughly all strongly coupled at the UV cutoff. And if you look at the running of a theory which starts near its Landau pole, is coupled to a CFT with a large number of colors and SO10 flavor symmetry, then the running mimics, if you just look at the structure of that running, it mimics the formulas you see for weakly coupled perturbative guts. The flavor symmetry imprints something that looks like the flavor symmetric beta function adds a sort of large log value to all of the 3-2-1 couplings that looks like a unified gauge coupling. And then there are some perturbations coming from all the fundamental fields which are not in complete SO10 multiplets. So the standard model fields are not in SO10 multiplets. The Higgs sector, CFT, is in SO10 multiplets, and therefore doesn't make a big impact on the running, the differential running.
What was the issue with the third generation being partial?
So if it were very simple and I said, you know, there are some particles which are just weakly coupled, standard model quantum numbers, and then there were some other thing which is strongly coupled but SO10 symmetric, so it doesn't contribute to differential running, then you would say, oh, just add the two, okay? One does nothing, it's strongly coupled but it's SO10 symmetric, and the other is weakly coupled, and just calculate it. But of course, partial compositeness changes that, because it says that the top quark, top left and top right, are each really coupled to the CFT in a way that is fairly strong. That is, they're not decoupling over the large hierarchy, they are staying interacting with the CFT. So I can't call those particles either just fundamental particles totally divorced from the CFT, neither can I say they are exactly SO10 symmetric, because these things that I've coupled to the CFT are not in complete multiplets. So you're driving the CFT to a new CFT, right? You've added relevant operators that drive a symmetric CFT to a slightly non-symmetric CFT, especially once you go to subleading order in 1 over n. So that's the subtlety there.
Okay, I think we'll move on to the next talk. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Oh.